First Chronicles, beginning a new book tonight. As we head through the scriptures on Sunday nights from Genesis to Revelation and find ourselves in the first book of Chronicles. A lot of times there's a tendency on the part of people, and probably all of us, when we're reading through the Bible for the first time and we come to 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the tendency is to say, hey, this is just a repetition of 1st and 2nd Kings. That's the tendency to look at it that way. And even if it was, I wouldn't have a complaint with that. I don't know how much you learn when you've just been told something once. I'm not a real fast learner. I never have been. Once I learned it, I got a pretty good hold on it. But I, you know, those kids in school that would just pick that stuff up, I'd go home and I'd look at all those theorems and postulates and all those rules of grammar. And I know I'm talking about math and English, two different things. And I would just stare at those things for hours, it would seem, before they'd just finally break loose a little bit. And so I'm the kind of person that has to be told something over and over and over again. And then finally I start to get kind of a grasp on it. So if 1st and 2nd Chronicles was just simply God repeating himself in the light of his knowledge of who he's dealing with, and that's you and I, then it would be very, very valuable just as a repetition. But it's more than that. 1st and 2nd Kings deals with the history of the nation of Israel and deals with that section of their history related to the kings from the vantage point of the political record of the nation, the political history of that period. In 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the emphasis is more of the religious record during that period. And so God leaves out vast amounts of information that he had in 1st and 2nd Kings, huge blocks of David's reign aren't even mentioned, the fall with Bathsheba, so much not even mentioned there. But where he is mentioned is where it's important and pivotal as it relates to God's spiritual work through the nation. And so there's a lot in 1st and 2nd Chronicles that you don't find in 1st and 2nd Kings because of the difference of the emphasis. In 1 Chronicles, there's an awful lot of genealogies. Those of you who read through the first few chapters, as was suggested, you realize there's an awful lot of names in there. Now, I'm not a big genealogy person. I watched Roots on television when I was growing up, and that's about the closest I got to any genealogy, mine or anybody else's. And I appreciate, that different people in the world, and some of you may be just massively into genealogies, and you've traced yourself back 100 million generations, and you got the whole thing, on a chart in the dining room wall at the house and that kind of thing. And that's great if that's, but, for me, give you an idea what I care about genealogies. I stopped with two daughters. I have a nephew. It's all up to him to carry that Kyle name on into, the 21st century and however. To me, it's like I'm here. I'm here for God's purposes. I'm thrilled to have two daughters, thrilled to have a wife, thrilled that they have anything to do with me. But I'm not, going to carry that thing all over the place and all. That part of that is just personality, and part of it's just the country we live in, because we're, this blend of so many different things that sometimes a genealogy is less important, certainly less important to us typically in this nation than it is to the Jews. For the Jews, genealogies were very important because they didn't have elections for their elected officials. They had kings, and kings were appointed related to their genealogy. And it was very important for you to be able to tie yourself to the the kingly genealogy and lineage, and to prove yourself to be next in line to be king or to be a part of, that, you know, royal family. It's always been lucrative to be, you know, associated with the royal family. They got the big thing going on over in England. We'll get into our passage here in just a moment. But the big thing going on, I forget what the net worth of the Queen of England is. It's like $500 million. Yeah, that's a pretty good set. I don't know how you know, work something like that out, but that's a pretty good deal, and they're wondering whether, you know, the royal family is really important to England and all that kind of thing. But, you know, it's lucrative to be associated with the royal family, and when things were going well. Another thing that was important as it related to genealogies for the Jews was it was the means by which the Levites and the priests could tie themselves to the tribe of Levi and also to the genealogy of Aaron so that they could prove that they were of that lineage and thus allowed to do the priestly duties and also allowed to be involved in all of the physical tasks associated with the tabernacle and then the temple. And so, you know, if you were a Levite and you couldn't prove through your genealogy that you were a Levite and, you know, you ended up out there in the fields with the Kyles, you know, farming wheat or something. I mean, for us, we'd be thrilled to be farming wheat, but there you are, a Levite, you want to be in there, you know, dealing with the things in the temple, and you'd want your genealogy to prove that you could do that. It was also important as it related to property ownership, and God was very careful in the law to make sure that land as much as possible stayed within the hands of a family so that you couldn't have, you know, the concentration of wealth that is sometimes, you know, dangerous to the health of a nation. And so the land was spread between the 12 tribes and then spread among the families of the 12 tribes. And if you went into debt and you had to sell your land, well, a kinsman redeemer could go ahead and redeem that land so it wouldn't leave the family. And land was important. And you go to Israel today and the Jews, they talk about the land, the land, the land. The land is very, very important to them. And it kept wealth distributed through the nation. It was interesting. I was watching the news, you know, last couple of days, and I don't know why I do it, but I do. I watch this news stuff, and they were talking about not only the concentration of wealth in the United States of America, and I'm not making any editorial comment as it relates to that. We were talking about the concentration of wealth in the entire world. They said the top 200 corporations in the world hold fully 60% of the world's wealth. That's a lot of wealth. And God had among His nation a way that the wealth stayed distributed among the families. And so it was important as it related to property ownership, identifying kinsmen redeemers, kinsmen redeemer who could then redeem your property if you ever sold it or you sold yourself. It was also important as it related to you know, determining the oldest sons for the inheritance. If you were the oldest son in a Jewish family, all the sons got an inheritance. The oldest son got twice of what anybody else got. And so that was the blessing that went with the birthright. As we read through all of these names, and we're not going to read through them, but as you read through them and as we read through some of them, it's interesting to me that whenever I read through a genealogies of this kind of length, and there's like 6 or 8 chapters that are largely genealogies, to me it's like walking through a graveyard. I've heard it attributed that way, and to me it really is. When I was a kid, I have a twin brother, and one of the things that we used to do when we were, you know, young and in elementary school and all, the movies were a quarter back then. I remember Son of Flubber was a quarter to get into that. And it might as well, you know, it might as well have been $1 million for us. I mean, for us to get a quarter would have involved theft of some kind. And so it was just, and one of the things we would ride our bikes anywhere and everywhere in town. One of the things we would commonly do is we'd ride our bikes to the cemetery. And we just look at all the stones, the tombstones. Look and see how long this one lived and this one, and look at how many they got into this small little area. You know, they got all this, they'd stack them or something. You know, I mean, they had, and then you'd go into where they, you know, they have the, I don't know what they call them, is it the mausoleums, or they have the little cubicles and all that. And, you know, and your kid, we'd ride our bikes through, and our bikes didn't have brakes, and we'd run into the wall and run into tombstones. It was a, you know, an absolute mess. But one of the things about going through a cemetery, not so much even in your youth, but as you get older, is it really makes you aware of the fact that life is a vapor. It really makes you aware of how fast life goes. And it really makes you aware of eternity. Because in that cemetery, you know, except for the gardeners and stuff like that, everyone in there is dead. They're not a single thing they can do for the kingdom at that point. It's over. Their ministries are through. And so it really brings you face to face with eternity. And you know that sometimes it's good for that to happen. And you look at all of these names, and some of them are names that we'll recognize as being, you know, heroes of the Old Testament. Other names are, you know, more anonymous. We don't know anything more about them except their name. But, you know, death is the real great equalizer, isn't it? I mean, it's just, the names just, they just end up getting listed. And when I read through these kind of genealogies, one of the things that I look at is these guys don't have any more of an opportunity to expand the kingdom of God and to serve the Lord. And, you know, we still do. We still have an opportunity to do that. So it brings us face to face with eternity. One of the things that I also look at when I look at genealogies, and I again look at genealogies of this kind of length, is you look at just name after name after name after name, some we know, some that we don't know, but it's all a sea of humanity. It's all a sea of sinful man. The very best of men that are listed in there, great sinners. David, one of my heroes of the Old Testament. And you'll never hear me slamming David. And I know how he fell. I know the greatness of his fall. I know how it hurt the work of God. I know the difficulty that was a part of his family afterwards and all of those things. But David is just a giant to me. Always will be. Just absolutely a giant. So, but the greatest of men, sooner or later, the feet of clay, you women know. And we know about you. One of the things about, as I look at the genealogy, is it just makes you realize, Lord, you are willing to introduce yourself into that sea of sinful humanity in order that you might provide a redemption for us. That you might provide a salvation for us. You know, if we go through this genealogy and we see our name in there, you know, it fits. But you stop for a minute and you add Jesus' name into those genealogies, and you realize enormous price was paid. Tremendous glory was set aside. And self-denial occurred in order that you and I might be saved tonight. And that's one of the things about these genealogies, especially as we go through them a little bit, is that we'll see that they begin to tighten down and tighten down in their focus in order to show us. And their main focus becomes the lineage through which the Messiah, the Savior of the world, was going to come, Jesus Himself. So we pick it up in chapter 1. And interestingly enough, man's genealogy begins with a man by the name of Adam. Why would God begin this genealogy with the name of Adam? Well, probably because Adam was the first man that He created. Eve came out of Adam, but Adam was the first man that was created. He could have started, you know, further along in his genealogy. I mean, he could have just jumped right over to Abraham, but he doesn't do it, does he? He begins with Adam. Why does he begin with Adam? I'm convinced that unless a person goes all the way back to Adam with their questions concerning life, then none of life is going to make sense to you. This isn't going to happen. I have a very close relative who is involved in a particular religious system. And the religious system that she's involved in is a kind of a nice moral religious system and has a lot to commend it in some ways. But as I've talked with her about it, I said, you know, it doesn't answer the questions that I have to have answered in order for me, you know, to trust the truthfulness of moral teaching? In other words, one of the questions that has always been in my mind, you know, from my youth and into adulthood was, how did we get here? And I find that Genesis chapter 1 and 2 answers that question. I find only Genesis chapter 1 and 2 properly answers that question to satisfy me, how we got here. The creation of Adam and Eve, man created, the heavens and the earth created. And so the creation of man, why is man the way that he is? That's a question. And I remember in college, you know, take all these philosophy classes and anthropology classes and all these different things, and you're asking all of these questions and different things. And one of the things that I never had satisfactorily answered for me by anyone was, why is man the way that he is? I mean, there were explanations, but they didn't satisfy. And then I come to the Bible and I look, and God says man was created perfect and he fell from that perfection and sin was introduced into mankind, and because of that sin, men and women are now born sinners, and that's the explanation for why man is the way that he is. And why, and what is man? Man is a sinner. That's 5.5 billion of us on the face of this planet. Every single one of us, common denominator, is that we're sinners. And so the Bible is a record. The very simple encapsulation of the Bible is that it's the record of the creation of man, the fall of man, and then the redemption of man. That's what the whole book is written about. And nothing makes sense unless I take it all the way back to Adam. Now, the great philosophical question that gets raised, and I've mentioned this before in previous studies, but I'll mention it here before we leave Adam, is a person will ask, and they have every right in asking it, and say, how do we know? What kind of physical or philosophical proof do we have that man was created something perfect and that he's fallen from that perfection and become something less, versus what we're being told on every quarter in the world today, and that is that man was, it came on the scene as something inferior and he's progressing into something greater. Why should we put the trust in the biblical account rather than the account of evolution and the variations of evolution that is being foisted on us all around? And God says, well, I'll wax philosophical with you. In Romans chapter 2, he says the proof of man's fall is in man's conscience. That man all over the world has a conscience. There's a uniform conscience, and a universal conscience. In other words, in every culture of mankind, there are certain things that are always right, and there are certain things that are always wrong. Stealing is always wrong. Lying is always wrong. Murder is always wrong. And the interesting thing about that uniform conscience that man has and consciousness of right and wrong is that his practice is lower than his conscience. And that indicates that the origin of his conscience must be greater than himself. And God says, I've left that fingerprint of the fact that man is created, was created perfect, and has fallen from that perfection. And he has become something lesser than what he was created to be in the existence of conscience. And the fact that conscience is higher than his practice. And I tell you, apart from going all the way back to Adam, this life is emptiness and frustration. And the answers that God gives us through Adam. So he takes us all the way back to Adam so that we can understand what we would not be able to understand otherwise. Then he moves on in verses 5 through 26 of chapter 1, and he deals with the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so, as you know, you read through these, all of us are, you know, descendants of Noah, descendants of one of these three. He lists the sons of Japheth there, beginning in verse 5. I'm not going to read them for you. Then in verse 8, he does a listing of the sons of Ham, and then beginning in verse 17, the listing of the sons of Shem. And he brings us in verse 28 to the sons of Abraham, which were Isaac and Ishmael. And he gives the descendants of Ishmael in verses 29 through 31, then the descendants of Isaac in verses 34 through 37, and then the descendants of Esau in verses 35 to 42. And then in verse 43, he describes and says, "Now these were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel." And then he goes through and he gives a listing of the kings that reigned in Edom before any king reigned from Israel within that land. Now, one of the things that's interesting to me, and it's a qualifying statement concerning genealogies, just because I don't have a tremendous interest in aptitude as it relates to genealogies, I have a sister who is, she's a corporate lawyer, and she's involved in international law as it relates to telecommunications. And she went to law school at the age of 50 to get her law degree, and she graduated working full-time, and this is what she does. I was talking with her last night, and I said, "Does that really interest you at all? I mean, I said, if somebody gave me a contract to negotiate the Sprint contract between the United States and Thailand, I'd look for the nearest exit." I mean, and so people have different things that are of interest to them, and that's of great interest to her. I'm convinced that God lists the names that He lists, whether it be the kings of Edom or the kings of the children of Israel, and they're listed for reasons that He may keep entirely to Himself until we go to be with Him. But it's interesting how, you know, the old saying is that the spade of the archaeologist is the friend of the Christian. I mean, keep on digging out there, man, because if they'll be honest in their digs, it's amazing what they find. It's only been in the last 100 years that professors have ceased to call the Bible a fraud based upon its mentioning of King Nebuchadnezzar. They say there was no King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar is mentioned all through the Bible. I mean, there's no record of King Nebuchadnezzar, no ancient record, blah, blah, blah. And so the dismissing of the Bible over a failure for there to be an ancient record as it related to King Nebuchadnezzar in terms of an archaeological find and all this kind of thing. And then, you know, they ended up digging and hit the site of the ancient city of Babylon. And then sure enough, on every brick, guess whose name was on it? There's old Nebi's name right there, Nebuchadnezzar, on every single brick. Now, wouldn't it have been a shame if you'd have thrown your faith away, because of that argument? So, God, I think He lays all these things out, and guys like me will look at them and will go, you know, that's not going to affect my faith one way or another, and we skip over them. And then, you know, then you got the guys that got the big, thick glasses. I got, you know, they like nothing more than to break these names down in the Hebrew and look them up in all of the atlases and dig through the whole thing and all. And then, bam, they'll hit something and that'll be the thing that anchors them. It's great. All the diversity within the body and the diversity in the Word. So all of it's important, and only the Lord knows how important all of it is. But He lists these kings of Edom there in verse 43 all the way through the end of chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, He lists the sons of Israel. And the sons of Israel were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And so He lists the 12 sons of Israel, after which the 12 tribes were named. And then He goes on and in verse 3, and He lists the sons of Judah, the genealogy of the sons of Judah. And He says, "The sons of Judah were Er and Onan and Shelah, and these three were born to him by the daughter of Shua the Canaanitess. Er, the firstborn of Judah, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and God killed him." So, we don't know too much more than that, but that makes a tough tombstone. But that's all he was known for. Just known for being wicked and killed by God. And Tamar, his daughter-in-law, bore him Perez and Zerah. All the sons of Judah were five. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. And the sons of Zerah were Zimri, Ethan, Haman, Kalkol, and Dara, five of them in all. The sons of Carmi was Achar, or also known as Achan, the troubler of Israel, who transgressed in the accursed thing. He's the one that's mentioned there in Joshua, who hid the accursed thing from the spoils of Jericho and ended up being killed for that. All of the nation of Israel was affected by it. So we see Ur here, we see Achan, and you know, the great remembrance of their life is failure. And so, you know, the Lord adds that in there so that that won't become the great remembrance of our life. Doesn't have to be, does it, in Jesus? I was talking recently with a man, and not from here, so don't try and figure him out. And as we were talking, you know, just further we went on in the conversation, just, you know, I was getting the drift that this guy's identification in terms of who he was as a Christian was in everything but the person of Jesus Christ. I said, boy, you know, I would like you to read Ephesians chapters 1 through 3 and find out who you are in Christ. I mean, you've made, you know, your family background your identity, you've made this your identity, that your identity, you've made every failure of your life your identity, every sin present tense in your life your identity. Let's find out what our identity is in the Lord, in Christ Jesus. And so, even if our life has been a failure up to this point, you know, and they've already got, Satan's got the tombstone cut, you know, another failure, Damien Kyle failure, smitten by the Lord or something. Even if he's got the whole thing cut, I can turn to the Lord and everything change, because my identification becomes entirely different in him. Sometimes, you know, the world gets upset over the broadness of God's offer concerning that, isn't it? Isn't it amazing how many of those killers turn to the Lord? Does it ever bug you? You ever feel like, you know, even if you hadn't come to know the Lord, that you wouldn't have killed somebody? Bet you could have. If everything was just right, the capacity there, God's grace moved away from our lives even before we came to know Him. And so often, you know, you'll read and, you know, Dahmer. I mean, the guy was a cannibal. You know, you're not only killing, but, you know, saving parts. And I mean, this is pretty, you wonder what kind of a mind, what kind of a, and yet in the final months of his life, apparently a strong turn to the Lord, a legitimate one before he was struck down in the prison. A monster? Absolutely. But you know something? I can look at a Dahmer, and I don't know about your heart. And again, there's a side of me that's appalled by it. I don't want you to think that, you know, we like our pastor to abhor things like that. So there's a sense. But you know, there's very little that I look at in the world today that I don't think myself capable of apart from the Lord. Just the way I see it. And so this guy comes in, and even in the final months of his life, gives his life to the Lord and expresses his sorrow, does like Manasseh did, and that was tried to undo the harm that he had done, and asking for forgiveness and these things. And no matter what limitations man may put on grace, and sure, I'm not saying anything about capital punishment or any kind of consequences of sin, these kinds of things, but you know, whatever limitations we may put on grace, God seems to be very free with His grace. And that man, if he turned his life over to the Lord, his identity completely different. And I believe, I don't care what a person's background, because the Bible teaches it, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. I believe in the spiritual birth. I don't believe that there's any other explanation for my life today, except for the fact that God is real and He came inside of me. And I believe that about so many of you, it's so obvious, it's easy to believe that. But I believe it about all of you. And if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all everything's become new. And that goes for anyone. And so here, in the Lord, in Christ, Satan doesn't need to fit us for that kind of an epitaph. You know, it can be something entirely different. So God, though, he lists these guys in just a waste, you know, in terms of what they decided to live for and what they decided to die for. And the son, verse 8, of Ethan was Azariah. Also the sons of Hezron, who were born to him, were these guys. And Ram begot Aminadab, and Aminadab begot Nashon, leader of the children of Judah. Nashon begat Salma. Salma begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed, and Obed begot Jesse, who we're getting close to, and close to David, aren't we? David begot Eliab, his firstborn, Abinadab the second, Shimeah the third, Nathaniah the fourth, Araniah the fifth, Ozem, I guess, the sixth, and David the seventh. And so there's King David. We see his genealogy in there. Now, elsewhere we read that David was the eighth son. And so you say, well, here's the seventh, here's the eighth. Maybe one of his brothers died somewhere in there, and so went from being the eighth, and then by the time this genealogy was put together, he was then the seventh. Now, their sisters of these seven brothers were Zeruiah and Abigail, and the sons of, you know, the first sister were Abishai, Joab, and Ashiel, three. So these two sisters were half-sisters of David, and we find out that they had a different father in 2 Samuel chapter 17, verse 25. Now, we don't know that David's father might have married David's mother, after she had already been married, and we don't know what might have happened to the first husband. It's all speculation. But somehow, she had these two daughters, and they had a different father, and they were half-sisters of David. It's interesting in verse 16, and the reason that I bring it up is the listing of Abishai, Joab, and Ashiel, these three brothers, because they're going to play a prominent part in the rest of these two books. They're going to be tremendous military men and mighty men in fighting with David. The fascinating thing that so often gets overlooked is that these were also his nephews. Joab was his nephew. And so David, being the younger son of his father, and then these sisters, if they were born before any of the sons were born, would have made them much older than David, and their children could have been very much the same age. So when you think of, you know, when you think of David and Joab, and you think of, you know, David in a certain age, and then Joab, you know, at 9 years old or something, it's nothing like that. They're probably pretty close to the same age. Abigail bore Amasa, and the father of Amasa was Jether the Ishmaelite. We'll skip over to chapter 3 as it lists the different families of Hezron and Caleb and all. Now, these were the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron. The firstborn was Amnon by this particular wife, the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel, by Abigail, the Carmelitess. The third, Absalom, and the son of her, the daughter of this and the king. And then the fourth, Adonijah. The fifth, Shephaniah, and then the sixth, Ithream. And these six were born to him in Hebron. There he reigned 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. So he had these six sons during those 7 years, 6 months, during his reign there in Hebron before he ended up reigning in Jerusalem for the final 33 years. Now, these are the sons that were born to him in Jerusalem. Shimeah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, these four were born to him by Bathsheba, another name for Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel. And also there was Ibhar, Elishama, Eliphelet, Nepheg, Jaffa, whatever, Elishama. I feel so ashamed. I really don't. It's the best I can do. And Eliada, you know, you might be thinking there, those of you who are really smart, you might be thinking, you know, you can write the correct pronunciation in the margin, but, you know, I've done that and still goofed them up. So I just, this is, and then Eliphlet, nine in all. So these were the nine sons. These were all of the sons. It's a listing of a total of 19 here. Those weren't all of the sons that David had. David had other sons by his concubines. And so these were all the sons of David besides the sons of the concubines and Tamar, their sister. And so David had a lot of concubines, had a lot of wives, and had a lot of children. In beginning in verse 10, there is the genealogy of the sons of Solomon, and it takes us the rest of the way through chapter 3. And then in chapter 4, it lists the sons of Judah, and all of them are listed there. This is a different line, lineage of genealogies from the lineage of chapter 2. And so it carries down through a different lineage, and we'll skip it over to verse 9, because in the middle of all of these names, God speaks about Jabez, and he said, now Jabez was more honorable than his brothers, and his mother called his name Jabez, saying, because I bore him in pain. So here's God laying out all these genealogies, and you know, this is all being written by his inspiration. He's laying out all these things, and this name, and this name, and this name, and this name, and then he hits Jabez. And he kind of gets an urge to pull a picture out of his wallet. And he just kind of says, I want to tell you a little more about this Jabez guy. And so he talks about Jabez, and he says that Jabez was more honorable than his brothers. The word honorable is interesting. It means to be heavy. Jabez was a spiritual heavyweight. He was heavier than, you know, the light-weighted spiritual, you know, ness around him. And it's interesting that it says he was more honorable than his brothers. In other words, he lived his life in such a way that God's standard was the standard for his life, and not only not the world, but not even God's people, not even his brethren. And so he was somebody that stood out, and so God allows him to stand out because of his, you know, seriousness as it relates to things spiritual. He was born into a pretty tough situation. He apparently it was a very, very difficult delivery for his mother, because his mother named him "He Will Cause Pain." That's a tough name. That becomes his identification. What's your name? He will cause pain. Well, excuse me. Mind if I walk on the other side of the street from you? I mean, that's a pretty heavy thing to be branded by on that. And yet, part of his spiritual heavyweightness is that he called on the God of Israel. He was a man of prayer, and notice what he prayed. He prayed, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed." I think that's important as a Christian person, is to cry out for the blessings of God. There's nothing wrong with that. You should cry out for the Lord to bless me. Lord, I don't want me to bless me, or I don't want to, you know, try and pin you with one of your promises or some kind of a thing like, you know, but I cry out and I ask that you would bless me indeed. Lord, you bless me by your definition. It's a great thing to ask for. Ask for the Lord to bless me. Lord, you bless me. I ask you to bless me. There's nothing wrong with that. And I don't walk with him or not walk with him based upon what his blessings are. And I accept whatever he defines as being a blessing for my life. But there's nothing wrong with crying out and say, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed." And then he says, "And enlarge my territory," or "enlarge my coast," or "my border." I love that. That's one of my favorite verses in the whole Old Testament. He prayed that he would be blessed and that his coasts or his borders would be enlarged. When's the last time, just, you know, in the privacy of our own heart, when's the last time I prayed that to the Lord concerning my influence in the world for his kingdom? Lord, that you would enlarge my coasts for your glory, for your kingdom. Lord, I'm happy with what you've done so far, so thankful, testimony of your grace. But Lord, would you enlarge my coasts as it relates to the influence in this world that can be through my life. That's maturity. And that's a spiritual heavyweight, that crying out for that. There aren't enough people that cry out for that. And then he said that your hand would be with me. Lord, I want your blessings, but I don't want them apart from you. I want your hand to be with me, and that you would keep me from evil, and that I may not cause pain. And so God granted him what he requested. He said, oh Lord, that you would keep me from evil. That's a good prayer. Jesus taught us to pray that on a daily basis. Lord, lead me not into temptation. Deliver me from the evil one. That's a good one, isn't it? I think concerning temptation, we looked at it a few weeks ago on a Sunday morning, but we just sit in a room this size, this number of people here, myself included, in the room. And we wonder, since Jesus teaches us to pray about temptation on a daily basis, it must mean what? It must mean we're going to be tempted probably on a daily basis. Right? And I don't know about you, but that's about the frequency in my life. It happens on a daily basis. And so often a person can be involved in the most difficult temptation. And you can ask him and say, when is the last time you began the day and asked the Lord, Lord, lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from the evil one? I think it was back in 1973, I think I prayed that. It was the last time. Or the last time, you know, they sang it as one of the worship songs there at church, I think. You see, and the interesting thing is that Jabez asks the Lord for this, and the Lord gives it to him. In other words, Jesus doesn't want us just to pray that, but he has every intention of answering that prayer. So he asked that he would be kept from evil, and then he asked, Lord, and that I may not cause pain. Keep me from evil, that I may not cause pain. That's a mature man. That's a mature godly man. Lord, I don't want to get involved in evil. I don't want my life to be a life that inflicts pain on people. And it's a recognition of the fact that he had the capacity to do it, and he knew he did. He knew he did. That's a great prayer. Lord, I don't want my life to inflict pain in people's life. And the Lord liked that prayer. He liked the request that had been made, and the Lord granted him what he requested. Then in verse 23, these are the potters and those who dwell at this city and that city, and there they work with the king for his work. In verse 24, we have the sons of Simeon, the genealogy of the sons of Simeon that are listed, and we pick it up in verse 39. And so, giving us some insight into their situation in the land, we're told. And so they went to the entrance of Gedor, as far as the east side of the valley, to seek pasture for their flocks. And they found rich, good pasture, and the land was broad and quiet and peaceful, for some Hamites formerly lived there. And these recorded by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And they attacked their tents and the Meunites who were found there and utterly destroyed them as it is to this day. And so they dwelt in their place because there was pasture for their flocks there. Now some of them, 500 men of the sons of Simeon, went to Mount Seir, having as their captains these guys, and they defeated the rest of the Amalekites who had escaped. They have dwelt there to this day. And so God gives us some insight into how they had gained that section of land in the land and the battle that had taken place for that. In chapter 5, we have the genealogy of the sons of Reuben, and we're told, now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the first son of Jacob, later renamed Israel, and he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, he committed sexual immorality his father's wives and concubine, and his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's. And so here we have a record of Reuben, who, you know, for a moment of sexual pleasure threw away, his place in the history of the nation of Israel and just, you know, so much gets thrown away apart from that self-control. And so God makes a record of it so that we would continue on into this day to, learn the lesson of it. One of the most important things as it relates to temptation, and certainly as it relates to sexual temptation, is just to take a few minutes before you ever find yourself in the middle of that temptation and count the cost ahead of time. Just not while you're in the middle of the temptation. That's a bad, my mind needs to be made up before I get into the middle of that kind of a temptation. What I'm going to do. That's what Joseph did. I mean, it was a settled issue how he's going to deal with Potiphar's wife, and he got out of there. But there needs to be that thing of just sitting and saying, what will this cost me? What will this cost me, and how far-reaching will the consequences be? And that's something that Reuben never did, and the consequences were very far-reaching. In chapter 5 and verse 11, we have the genealogy of the children of Israel, and the children of Gad, and we'll skip down to verse 18. The sons of Reuben, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 valiant men, able to shoot, to bear spear and a shield and sword, and to shoot with the bow, and skillful in war, who went to war. And so, Gad, the name of Gad was a troop, and so along with the other tribes that were listed here of Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they had quite a military force. Remember, in those days, they didn't have police forces and those kind of things. You needed to have a strong military because you're going to get, wiped out by invading marauders or whatever it might be. And they made war with the Hagrites, Jetur, Naphish, and Nodab, and they were helped against them, and the Hagrites were delivered into their hand and all who were with them. And why did it happen? For they cried out to God in the battle, and God heeded their prayer because they put their trust in Him. And I love that relationship between that word prayer and trust, because that's what prayer is. It's an expression of faith in God. That's how he views it. He viewed it as trust being placed in Him. And then they took away their livestock, 50,000 of their camels, 250,000 of their sheep, and 2,000 of their donkeys, also 100,000 of their men, for many fell dead because the war was God's, and they dwelt in their place until the captivity. And so the children of the half-tribe of Manasseh dwelt in the land. Their numbers increased from Bashan to Baal Hermon, that is to Senir, to Mount Hermon. And these were the heads of their father's houses that list those guys. They were mighty men of valor, famous men, and heads of their father's houses. It's kind of nice to read that about men. It's almost like if a man was valiant today, I think they'd send him to another country. I don't know what the fearful thing is for a man to be a man today. But I mean, God wasn't ashamed of the fact that his men were what he wanted men to be. And so here they were. They were men of valor and heads of their father's houses and famous men. And then this particular group, they, coupled with a bad characteristic, they were unfaithful in where they, landed as the half-tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan River. They were unfaithful to the God of their fathers, and they played the harlot after the gods of the peoples of the land whom God had destroyed before them. And so the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of the king of Assyria, and he carried the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh into captivity. He took them to Hala, Habor, and Hara, to the river of Gozan, to this day. So you remember those 2.5 tribes? They didn't want to go into the promised land. They liked the land on the east of the Jordan River, and so they said, we'll go in with the other tribes and we'll help them fight for the land and get the land, but we like the grazing land on this side. And so they didn't want to enter fully into God's promises of the land. And so they ended up being the first to be taken in captivity. In chapter 6, there's the listing of the sons of Levi. And these, of course, were the Levites, and the priests came out of this tribe. And there's the listing of the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And the sons of Kohath are listed there from verse 2, and then The sons of Gershon are listed there from verse 17 and 17, and then from verse 19 on, it talks about the sons of Merari. And so these leaders that were in the family. Interesting, in verse 22, the sons of Kohath were Aminadab his son, Korah his son, Asir his son. And so here we find Korah from Numbers chapter 16. He was the guy that led the rebellion against Moses. It gives us interesting insight into that situation to know that he was a Levite. If you thought he was just a regular kind of guy, you know, creating an insurrection, that's not entirely what was happening there. He was a Levite. And he had responsibilities. God had a call on his life. He had things that he needed to do in terms of the physical things related to the tabernacle. And yet he wanted, you know, the higher position of associated with Aaron, the brother of Moses, and doing the work of the priest, which he wasn't qualified to do. And so here was a guy that wasn't satisfied with his call. And so he created a big problem. And of course, Korah is a crafty kind of a guy, because he never comes on the scene and says, listen, I know I'm a Levite, I'm not of the lineage of Aaron in order that I can be a priest, but I want to be a priest, and so I'm going to create a big revolution here among God's people in order that I can fulfill my selfish ambition. He never comes with that kind of directness. He made it into this something, make it appear as if it's something else, and then leads the, you know, a significant portion of the nation in rebellion against Moses. And so, but here we get insight into the fact that he was a Levite. And Eliab, verse 27, his son, as we jump in the middle of these genealogies, Jeroham, his son, Elkanah, his son, who was the father of Samuel. The sons of Samuel are listed there, so we see names that we recognize from 1 Samuel, Elkanah, and also Samuel, Elkanah's son through Hannah. And then in verse 31, I mean, you know, what group of people would be complete without the artistic types and the music people? And so here in verse 31, now these are the men whom David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest. And so here's a listing of, you know, the kind of the worship leaders and the singers there associated with the worship of the Lord. Verse 32, they were ministering with music before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of meeting until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. And then, and these are the ones who ministered with their sons. Of the sons of the Kohathites were Heman, the singer. There's a title for you. And so then it heads right on through. Verse 39, we see Asaph listed there. That's a name you'll recognize from the Psalms. He was an author of many of the Psalms, really some of the most beautiful Psalms in the book of Psalms written by Asaph. And so there's the listing of these different men. And then in verse 49, but Aaron and his sons, lineage of the sons of Aaron, the lineage of the priesthood, offered sacrifices on the altar of burnt offering and on the altar of incense for all the work of the most holy place and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. And these were the sons of Aaron, Eleazar his son, Phinehas his son, and then it gives his different sons. The priests offered the offerings, and they were involved with the different sacrifices and ceremonies associated with the temple and the tabernacle. The Levites did the physical work. It was kind of like a separation that we might in a modern day look at between elders and deacons. And the deacons today, they take care of the physical things. That's kind of what the Levites did. And then the other things in terms of the sacrifices were taken care of by the priests. Verse 54. Now these are their dwelling places, as it lists the cities of the priests throughout their settlements in their territory, for they were assigned by lot to the sons of Aaron of the family of the Kohathites. And so what God did with the priests and with the Levites is he scattered them throughout the land. Because they were Levites, you remember they were not given a portion of the land like the other tribes. God says, I am their portion. But he knew they needed a place to live and land, and also he apportioned cities that were to be given to the Levites, and he made sure that these cities were spread out through the land. In other words, he wanted to spread out the influence of the Levites and the priests among the people, so it wouldn't all be concentrated in Jerusalem or in some other place. And among those cities of the Levites that were given, one of the cities of refuge is listed there in verse 57, one of the six cities of refuge, Hebron, and they constituted a portion of the cities of the Levites. And then he lists how they were broken down and given to the Kohathites, and then it tells us in verse 62, to the sons of Gershon throughout their families, they gave 13 cities to the tribe of Issachar, and then through the different tribes, and then in verse 63, the sons of Merari, and how it was all spread out. And I'm not going to get into the detail of it there in chapter 6.